Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the IRA Academy 2021, an exclusive preview. And the reason why we're saying it's an exclusive preview is that we do have an IRA Academy coming up in May, and we've been receiving some questions on these three particular topics, and figured to go ahead and give a Reader's Digest or a quick overview of the topics to be able to answer some of the questions that we have been receiving. But before we get started, I'd just like to state that the Entrust Group does not provide investment advice or endorse any products or even provide legal advice. All the information and materials are purely for educational purposes, and parties are still encouraged to consult with their own internal attorneys, consultants, in regards to any questions they may have specifically on how to run or how to apply these items that we have in this particular seminar for your financial institutions. Let's first take a look at what the agenda is for today. We'll first take a look at what the IRA Academy is and a brief overview. I know some of the people that are attending this particular seminar or webinar is interested in the IRA Academy. And then we'll take a look at the three different topics that we'll be covering for today's seminar, one of which is IRA contributions, because we still are at contribution time, transfers and rollovers, which are common transactions that are being transacted. And some people have questions on that. Hopefully, we can demystify and answer your questions throughout the presentation. And if you have any questions later on, we're going to open up the phones for the floor for any questions you may have in regards to the material presented. And lastly, we're going to talk about required minimum distributions. Again, at the end of the course, which I'm shooting for about 50 minutes for the presentation and material, and it will go as long as we can. We want to in regards to answering any questions you may have. I know that the schedule says the webinar is about an hour, but if there are more questions, I don't mind going over an hour at all. My name is John Paul Ruiz, the Director of Professional Development here at the Entrust Group, and I've been in retirement education for over 26 years. I've been a director for large education providers such as Ascensus, Integrated Retirement Initiatives, and been educating investors, professionals, retirement professionals, as well as compliance people that run IRA programs for the organizations. I do hold a CISP designation, a Certified IRA Services Professional designation, and was a part of the team that created that particular designation when I was working for a company called Ascensus. And I also am a part of the American Society of Pension Professionals and Actuaries. Enough of myself. What is the IRA Academy? What is it? The IRA Academy is a four-day professional training course that prepares individuals who are candidates for what we call the IRA, for what we call the Certified IRA Service Professional designation. That is a designation held by a lot of IRA professionals in the industry that basically states that they've gone through a rigorous training and passed the test that allows for them to hold that particular designation. The IRA Academy is also approved for continuing education credits for other designations, such as the CTFA. That is a little bit of typo on the PowerPoint. CTFA, CRSP, which are designations through the American Banking Association as well. Along with that, Certified Financial Planner designation, as well as CPAs, Certified Public Accountants. One of the things I'm not seeing in the PowerPoint is enrolled agents, but for the IRS also are able to get continuing education credits for the IRA Academy. Who is it for? It's for financial advisors, banking personnel, trust officers, investment issuers, brokerage firm representatives, CFP, CPAs, or anybody who is who deals with the retirement space. In other words, is a retirement professional, whether it be you do the back shop work as a compliance person or operations, or someone who actually deals with clients today. There's over $33 trillion in retirement plan assets, and there's more and more sophisticated questions that are IRA holders are asking about their retirement plan assets, because a lot of them are thinking about retiring. Now, when is the IRA Academy going to be offered? This year, we're going to be offering it online. In other words, it's going to be live streamed. So you can do it at your home or an office. If you would like to attend, that'll be from May 17th through the 20th. And we also have a live session in September 6th through the 9th in Nashville, Tennessee. It's going to be held at the Barrett Training Center in Nashville, Tennessee, the home of the Tennessee Banking Association, where the Entrust Group also has a trust charter in the state of Tennessee. All right. We're going to open up the a polling really quick in regards to the people that are attending this particular course. I'm going to turn it over to Andrew real quick.
Good morning, everyone. As you'll see on your screen, we're just quickly trying to see exactly what interests you about IRA Academy, whether that's earning a CISP designation, earning CE credits for continuing education, or just trying to further your expertise and advance your career. Thank you very much, and we'll just leave this open to try to get as many folks as possible. Great, thank you very much. Cool, I'm gonna close the poll now.
Okay, perfect, Andrew, on with the course. All right, let's first take a look at IRA contributions. As I mentioned earlier, we are in contribution season, where typically the deadline to make a contribution for a prior year, in other words, if somebody wants to make a contribution for 2020, the typical deadline is April 15th, which is the tax return due date of an individual, not including extensions. However, the Treasury, because of the pandemic and financial hardships and, hardships that individuals are experiencing in filing their taxes, has extended that deadline to May 17th. In other words, there's an additional amount of time that individuals who is trying to contemplate whether or not they want to make a contribution for the prior year, they have an extended amount of time to make that contribution. Now, for this particular session, we're only going to be covering traditional IRA contributions first, and then we're going to cover the Roth IRA. First, start off with a traditional IRA. There are several contributions that can be made to a traditional IRA, and those are your annual contributions, transfers, rollovers, SEP contributions. As a matter of fact, so for some institutions, I get this call all the time. Somebody wants to make a SEP contribution, and we don't have such a thing as a SEP IRA. Can they still make that SEP contribution? The answer is yes. Because for all intents and purposes, your SEP IRA is nothing more than a traditional IRA receiving a contribution called a SEP contribution. The main difference is that the reporting of that contribution is reported in different boxes on what we call the IRS Form 5498. Annual contributions are reported on Box 1. SEP contributions are reported on Box 8 of the IRS Form 5498. Now, whatever trend code your system uses will be, you know, the thing that will trigger population of those rightful boxes. So in other words, if you use a trend code for a traditional IRA and reported a SEP contribution, which is up to 57,000 and reported on box one of the IRS form 5498, we have a problem because that should be reported on box eight. All right. So in other words, a traditional IRA could receive both contributions in the same year. It's just that those contributions must be reported in a different box. Lastly, traditional IRAs can also receive a recharacterization from a Roth. But for this particular presentation, we're only going to focus on annual contributions. Who can make a contribution to a traditional IRA? Here we go. With the passage of the Secure Act, one of the limiting factors before, which was age, is no longer a limiting factor. In other words, to make a traditional IRA contribution, there is no age limit. Whereas before, once an individual reaches the magical age of 70 and a half, they can no longer contribute for that particular year. That restriction has been lifted. So in other words, anybody, regardless of what age, has the possibility of being able to make a contribution. What do I say has a possibility? Because they still must have earned income. In other words, wages for services performed. Now, the IRS under Publication 590 has a wonderful chart that kind of illustrates to taxpayers what is and what isn't earned income. W-2, of course, is the safe harbor definition of earned income. In other words, if somebody receives a W-2 and they have income on that form, that's a safe harbor. In other words, acceptable, most acceptable way of proving that an individual has income. Some individuals also may be what we call entrepreneurs. In other words, they work for themselves. They don't receive a W-2. Those are also considered earned income as long as the income is positive. In other words, some people who are entrepreneurs filing what we call a Schedule C may have a loss. In other words, the amount of money that they made is less than the expenses that they paid out. So in other words, they have a loss. If it's a loss, that's not considered earned income. However, if it's positive, then that amount could be used as earned income because that amount of income is subject to what we call Social Security tax. Self-employed individuals do pay that what we call Social Security tax payment of 15.3% on incomes that they earn if their net business income is a positive. Again, there's no age limit, but there is an earned income requirement. There is no maximum earned income. So if an individual makes $1 billion, it may be exaggerated, but at least you get the point, that there is no limitation on who can contribute to a traditional IRA. The limiting factor that a lot of individuals or maybe even advisors sometimes get confused with is the term called deductibility. Can the contribution that they made, can it be used as a tax deduction? We'll take a look later on how the level of income could affect deductibility. Another variable in regards to contributions is what we call a spousal contribution. When a couple is married and filing a joint tax return, let's say one of them has earned income and the other one does not. Well, the other one who does not have earned income deserves a retirement plan too, and to contribute to their individual retirement arrangement. The earned income of the one who is working may now be used by the spouse who does not typically or obviously does not have earned income as long as they file a married couple filing a joint tax return. By virtue of the joint return, it doesn't matter anymore who earned the income. Both will be able to use the earned income earned under that tax filing to determine whether or not that spouse who does not have earned income is eligible to make a contribution. Of course, the earned income must still support the amount of contribution that's being made. So in other words, let's say the maximum contribution is $6,000 for someone who is under the age of 50. However, their earned income is only $3,000. Well, the maximum contribution then for making a contribution for that individual will be $3,000 because the level of earned income can also reduce the amount that they're eligible to make a contribution for the year. But back to spousal contributions. As long as a married couple is filing a joint tax return, the earned income earned by either spouse, since it's combined, can be used by either spouse. They still have to establish a separate IRA for each individual because IRA stands for individual. There's no such thing as a joint IRA, or else we'll be calling it a JRA, right? That's a little bit my attempt for humor, but humor me. So there's no such thing again as a JRA. It's an IRA. So everybody that has is making a contribution must make their contribution in their own individual retirement arrangement. So they have to set up their own IRA. The maximum contribution for 2020 and 2021. Why are we talking about 2021? Because they can still make a contribution for 2021 as well. In some cases, some people make, if they're under the age of 50, they make a $12,000 contribution as long as they designate the initial $6,000 for the prior year and the other $6,000 for the current year. Then they could actually dump, $12,000 if they're eligible for that at the same time. Now, keep in mind, if an individual is age 50 or older, they can make an additional contribution of $1,000. That's called a catch-up contribution, not a mustard, but a catch-up contribution. So in other words, if a person is 49, I've been asked this question before, can they make a catch-up contribution? The answer is it depends. It depends on whether or not they're going to have a birthday before the end of the year. Why is that? Because the rules state that as long as you're going to turn 50 before the end of the taxable year, that person is already eligible for a catch-up contribution. So in other words, if they're 49, as long as they're going to turn 50 at any time during the year, they can make a catch-up contribution anytime during that year. And the earliest time that they could actually make a contribution would have been January 2nd. Why January 2nd? Because most financial institutions are closed on January 1st. So in other words, the earlier you make a contribution, the better chance that you're going to earn on a tax-deferred basis on that contribution that's been made. So if an individual is eligible to make a catch-up contribution, in other words, they're 50 or older, not only can they make the $6,000, they can also make an additional $1,000. That makes their contribution a total of $7,000, assuming, of course, that they have enough earned income. For a couple, a married couple filing a joint tax return, and if they're both 50 and over, each one can make a contribution of $7,000 to each of their own individual IRAs, making a total of $14,000. If only one is age 50, then one will have $7,000 as their maximum contribution. And if the other one is under age 50, then their maximum contribution is six. All annual contributions must be in cash. I got asked a question before, can they make a contribution in the form of gold? The answer is no, because that's not cash. I've also been asked before, can they write a check? The answer would have been yes, that is cash. Right? Other types of dollars coming into an IRA, as illustrated in a couple of slides before, there are other types of contributions such as rollovers, or maybe even a non-reportable transaction called a transfer. Those does not have to be in cash. Why? Because those assets are already in existence in an IRA, just being moved to another IRA, as an example, or for a 401k plan being moved to an IRA. So in other words, only the annual contributions has a requirement that the contribution must be made in cash. The maximum contribution as well only applies to the annual contribution. So in other words, if you have a $500,000 from a 401k plan, you want to roll that into an IRA, that does not affect your annual contribution limit for a particular year. Now keep in mind, again, I'm trying to shoot for about 50 minutes for the presentation of the material, but if you do have a question, please jot those down, and I'll be more than happy to answer those once we get to that question and answer section. One of the main stumbling blocks, again, of some people saying, you know, I've heard this before from clients. I was told I'm not eligible to make a contribution to a traditional IRA because I'm covered by an employer-sponsored plan. What they really mean by that is they cannot make a deductible contribution to a traditional IRA because there is no income limit to a traditional IRA, number one. And being covered by an employer-sponsored plan does not nullify the eligibility for an individual to contribute to a traditional IRA. It may affect what we call their deductibility. In other words, the contribution that they're using, that they're making to a traditional IRA may not be deductible on their tax return. In other words, it cannot be used to reduce their taxable income if they make, number one, too much money, and number two, if they're covered by an employer-sponsored plan. What does it mean to be covered by an employer-sponsored plan? If a contribution was made on behalf of a participant of a 401k plan, 403b plan, SEP, or simple, then it means that they're covered. In other words, a deduction is already being received by either the contributor or the recipient. In other words, in a 401k plan, a participant is actually making contributions via what we call a payroll deduction. In other words, it's called a deferral. Or the employer could also be making a profit sharing contribution on behalf of an individual. That means that the individual is covered. If you ever get asked, how does an individual know whether or not they're covered or not? Well, check their W-2. There's a little box called pensions, a pension box on the IRS form W-2, that if that's checked, that tells the IRS that the person is covered. But if that box is not checked, the IRS will view that person not to be covered, right? If a person is covered, the level of their modified adjusted gross income will determine whether or not their contribution is deductible or not. Modified adjusted gross income, it just means that it's the adjusted gross income of an individual adding back certain things like student loan interest deductions or foreign earned income housing exclusion, which not everybody has that deduction. So therefore, for the most part, the adjusted gross income of the individual is what's used to determine whether or not an individual's traditional IRA contribution is deductible or not. Let's take a look at the chart for 2020 to illustrate what the concept is of how to determine whether or not a contribution is deductible or not. Let's take a look at a single or head of household filer. If the person, again, is covered by an employer-sponsored plan and they're single, we'll take a look at the first part of the chart, single or head of household filer. If the modified adjusted gross income of the individual is $65,000 or less, even if they're covered by an employer-sponsored plan, their contribution is fully deductible. Yay! If an individual has modified adjusted gross income that exceeds $65,000, that'll begin to phase out the opportunity to deduct their contribution. In other words, they will only receive a partial deduction. If their income or modified adjusted gross income exceeds $75,000, that tells the taxpayer that their contribution is not deductible at all. Now, they have some decisions to make. Do they still want to make a contribution called a non-deductible contribution? Or maybe another option would be is to consider the Roth IRA. Now, keep in mind, we haven't covered the Roth IRA yet. Some people make so much money that they may not be eligible for a Roth IRA. If they're not eligible for a Roth IRA, can they still make a contribution to a traditional IRA, even though they can't use it as a tax deduction? And the answer is yes. That contribution is what we call a non-deductible traditional IRA contribution. The next question should be, would it be smart for them to keep track of it? The answer would be absolutely. Because if they don't track it, when that amount comes out, it's going to get what? Taxed again. There is an IRS form that the individual must file in the year that they make a non-deductible contribution. Now, if they've made non-deductible contributions in years past, the current year non-deductible contribution will just increase that amount by filing an IRS form. In other words, they need to pick up from wherever they left off the last time they made a non-deductible contribution. And they need to add the contribution that they're currently making to that amount so that they track completely all non-deductible contributions that have been made in previous years as well as the current year, right? The IRS form that they need to file with the IRS with their tax return is called an IRS Form 8606. Right? IRS Form 8606. The financial institution does not file that form, but how many taxpayers know that they have to file that form? How many tax preparers know what that form is for? What we're finding out more and more is a lot of tax preparers never even heard of the form, unless the form comes up in their software, right? But if a taxpayer asks you, how do I keep track of what we call a non-deductible contribution? Well, it's using the IRS Form 8606. I've also heard of a client saying, well, isn't the institution tracking my contribution called a non-deductible contribution? The answer is no. Financial institutions do not track non-deductible contributions because those non-deductible contributions could have been made at any financial institution. Therefore, it's the taxpayer's responsibility. Now, this form has been around since 1987 because of the passage of the Tax Reform Act of 86 that affected deductibility. A lot of individuals may not have been keeping track of their IRS Form 8606. In other words, their non-deductible contributions in years past. But anyway, that's the taxpayer's responsibilities to keep track of their non-deductible contributions. Now, let's go back to the chart. If an individual makes more than $65,000 of modified adjusted gross income, what happens? Well, as an example, if the modified adjusted gross income of an individual is $70,000. Well, the question we need to ask is, where does $70,000 fall in relation to $65,000 and $75,000? Well, it's halfway, or 50%. What that tells us is that if the adjusted gross income, or modified adjusted gross income of the taxpayer is $70,000 or 50% within this chart, that only 50% of their contribution can be used as a tax deduction, right? For every $1,000 that goes above $65,000, it reduces their deductibility by 10%. You know, 10% for 66, 20% for 67, 30% for 68, until you get to 75. When you get to 75, it's 100% non-deductible at that point. So that's a good way to eyeball it. But keep in mind, again, if a person has a question in regards to deductibility, The best place to send them to is a competent tax or legal advisor. For a married couple filing a joint tax return, it's a little bit different because now we're dealing with two people. The modified adjusted gross income phase out range for a married couple filing a joint tax return is 104 to 124. Under 104, fully deductible between 104 and 124, partially deductible over 124, they won't get a deduction at all because they make too much money. For every 1,000 that goes over 104, it reduces their deductibility by 5%. Now, for married couples filing a separate returns, because they're already getting a tax break by filing a separate return, Congress makes it almost impossible for that person to get a deduction. It's still a possibility depending upon the type of or level of income that they make. The phase out range for them is zero to 10,000. Zero to 10,000, again, is the phase out range for a married couple filing a separate return. Hopefully you get the concept of deductibility. Again, financial institutions don't go through calculating deductibility for a taxpayer, but it's good to know the basics or the concept, right? Here's the a snapshot of the chart found on publication 590 on what is and what isn't taxable compensation. I'm going to move along. I just wanted to show this to you, so just in case a client goes, how do I know if my income is earned income or not earned income? Publication 590, as a matter of fact, to be specific, 590A, because publication 590 is broken down into two parts, contributions and distributions. A is contributions, B are distributions. All right, let's take a look at a Roth. In a Roth IRA, there are also several contributions that can be made. Annual contributions, transfers, rollovers, conversions. There's no such thing as a conversion in a traditional IRA because conversions only go one way, from a traditional to a Roth. You go from a taxable account into a tax-free account. But once you go from a tax-free, you never want to go back to a taxed account, right? That's why conversions, the contributions from a traditional IRA being distributed, can only be converted to a Roth. Therefore, conversions can only be contributed to a Roth. Recharacterizations are also a contribution type that goes into a Roth. But for this particular course, again, we're only going to focus on annual contributions. Who can contribute to a Roth IRA? Similar to your traditional IRA, there is no age limit. A person who has earned income that is working at age 75, even though they're taking required minimum distributions, can still make a contribution to a Roth because there's no required minimum distributions on a Roth. So in other words, if a person is age 75, again, still working part-time, and they wanted to make a Roth contribution, absolutely, they could be eligible for a Roth. Why do I say could? Because there are income limits in a Roth, whereas in a traditional, there's no income limit. Spousal contributions are also available for a Roth IRA, as long as the married couple is filing a joint tax return. Now, what you'll see here is almost exactly the same slide for the traditional. The reason for that is the maximum contribution for a given year for a taxpayer to any traditional or Roth IRA is shared. The maximum is shared by both a traditional and Roth IRA. So in other words, the $6,000 that we mentioned earlier for a traditional is shared by both a Roth and a traditional IRA. So any variations of contributions can be made to both a traditional and a Roth as long as the combination or combined total of all contributions does not exceed the limit. So in other words, you can contribute $3,000 to a traditional, $3,000 to a Roth, $1,000 to a traditional, $5,000 to a Roth if a person's under the age of 50. If they're over 50, then you know, $6,000 to a traditional, $1,000 to a Roth. As shown in the example earlier, in a traditional IRA, what if they can only deduct one half of their contribution to a traditional IRA? Well, maybe the best place to put the other half would be in a Roth IRA, as long as it's within the annual limit. All contributions to Roth IRAs must also be in cash, unless, of course, it's a transfer, it's a rollover, or other type of contribution of existing dollars already inside an IRA. Now, what determines whether or not the individual has exceeded the income limit in a Roth IRA? I kind of call it, if a person is rich, they can't make a contribution to a Roth. Well, what defines who's rich? Let's take a look at a married couple filing a joint tax return. When we take a look at a married couple filing a joint tax return, if their modified adjusted gross income, in other words, does this mean that the modified adjusted gross income is all the income that they received? Keep in mind that income has already been adjusted. Let me give you an example. Let's say an individual makes $200,000 for the year. Obviously, we can see on the chart that the $200,000 exceeds the $196,000. However, they participate in their employer's 401k plan and contributed $4,000 to their 401k plan. Well, guess what? Their gross income just got reduced by $4,000 to $196,000 because of that contribution to their 401k plan. In other words, their income was just adjusted. Other adjustments to the individual's income includes if you participate in an employer's, let's say, health insurance program. That is, in other words, you're making premium payments from your payroll. What's called is a cafeteria plan. In other words, if an individual participates in an employer's cafeteria plan, their income is also reduced by that cafeteria plan contribution. Flexible spending account contributions, or HSA deductions through a cafeteria plan, SEP contributions by entrepreneurs. Those are types of contributions that are used to reduce an individual's income to come up with the adjusted gross income, or even an HSA contribution made by the individual directly to an HSA account. Again, if an individual has questions about their adjusted gross income, have them go seek the assistance of a competent tax advisor. Now that we know the concept of adjusted gross income, let's apply the concept to determine Roth IRA eligibility income levels. All right. If an individual has less than $196,000 of modified adjusted gross income, well, they can still make a contribution to a Roth. If their income exceeds $196,000, it starts to phase out or it starts to limit their eligibility to contribute the full Roth contribution for a particular year. The moment their income exceeds $206,000, then they're no longer eligible to make a Roth contribution at all. However, remember, they could still make a traditional IRA contribution. The only thing that they need to determine is whether or not it's deductible or not. And if it's not deductible, they need to complete that IRS form 8606 to track the non-deductible contribution dollars. All right. Another benefit for individuals is what we call the tax savers credit. This is for an individual who does not have enough money to make a contribution to an IRA. In other words, it's addressing lower adjusted gross income levels of individuals. What I mean by that, again, is some people are saying, I barely make enough money to live on, let alone contribute several thousand dollars to an IRA. Well, Uncle Sam says, what if I meet you halfway? If you contribute to a retirement plan, what if I rebate you back or credit you back a certain level of taxes that you would have otherwise had to pay me? So now the individual has money to contribute to an IRA. That's what we call a tax savers credit. Again, by contributing to a retirement plan, if this individual falls below a certain income level, a certain percentage of their contribution, and by the way, for the formula, the maximum amount that can be used is $2,000, up to 50%, the maximum percentage is 50%, up to 50% of their contribution can be used to reduce the amount of taxes that they'll owe. Now, keep in mind, this is better than a tax deduction because this is what we call a tax reduction. In other words, the amount of taxes that they have to pay will be reduced, whereas a tax deduction just reduces the amount of income that's going to be subject to tax. The maximum tax credit, again, is $1,000 per taxpayer. So if you have a couple and each individual contributes at least $2,000 and their income it falls below enough that they qualify for the highest percentage, which is 50%, then each one of them can actually get up to $1,000 of tax credit. Now, keep in mind, the tax credit is non-refundable, which means that if an individual owes less taxes than the tax savers credit, the IRS will not give them back any amount that is above the amount of tax that they owe. So in other words, if they only owe $800 in taxes, even if they're eligible for a $1,000 tax credit, they're not going to get a $200 check. All right. Who is eligible for the tax credit? Anybody who's age 18 before the end of their taxable year cannot be claimed as a dependent, cannot have been a full-time student, and last but not least, must fall within the adjusted gross income limits. They also have to file an IRS Form 8880 with their tax return to avail of what we call the tax savers credit. All right. The deadline to make a contribution again is April 15. However, it's been extended again for 2021's tax filing date. In other words, for a tax year 2020 tax return, instead of having it be due on April 15th of 2021, it's now going to be due in May of 2021 because of the extension provided by the Treasury because of the pandemic. All right. Now, if an individual is making a contribution anytime between January 1st up until the tax return due date, as you notice, I didn't say extensions because extensions do not apply to make a contribution for annual contributions. They could essentially elect to make that contribution as a prior year contribution, but they have to make that election in writing. That's where your contribution forms come into play, is to capture that request by the taxpayer that they're making this contribution as for a prior year contribution. That contribution in turn can be made for the prior year as long as they elect it in writing. The IRS Form 5498 is what is provided to the Internal Revenue Service as well as for IRA holders that have made a contribution for a given year to prove that they have made that contribution. Tell IRA holders, if they ask you this question, to keep track of their IRS Form 5498 because this is the proof that a contribution has been made on their behalf. Now let's take a look at transfers and rollovers. Here's another common question as well a lot of people ask in regards to moving assets back and forth. In other words, portability. I joke about this, portability is not a mushroom, but in turn is the way to move assets. Are the assets in a retirement plan portable? Can you move it from one retirement plan to another? And here's one of them, it's called a transfer. A transfer is a non-reportable, non-taxable movement of plans of the same type. So in other words, if you want to move your traditional IRA, you can only move it to another traditional IRA via a transfer. Keep in mind, it's non-taxable and non-reportable. So there has to be an arrangement or an agreement between two financial institutions. If an individual is going to do a transfer, that number one, they're not going to report it. So therefore, number two, it's non-taxable because all they're trying to do is avail of a different investment from one institution to another. So in other words, you can do a transfer between a traditional to traditional, Roth to Roth, and a simple IRA to another simple IRA, unless, of course, a simple IRA that has satisfied what we call the two-year rule, meaning from the initial contribution, 2 years has passed. It's not from the establishment, but from the date of contribution after 2 years, then those simple IRA contributions can be treated as if they're traditional IRA contributions. Therefore, they can be moved to a traditional IRA after 2 years. Transfer rules. The same property must be transferred. If an individual is transferring a piece of property from one financial institution, well, the same piece of property must hit the other financial institution, because if it doesn't, well, there's something happened along the way. The IRA holder must also not have constructive receipt. In other words, the check is made payable to the other financial institution so that the individual cannot cash that check. And a common naming convention would be ABC Company for the benefit of the IRA holder's name and the IRA holder's IRA. Again, the financial institution for the benefit of the IRA holder, the type of IRA, and the account number in some cases. All right. There's no maximum number of transfers that an individual can do. In other words, you can do as many transfers as you want. It is also not subject to withholding or reporting. Why is that? Because if you're just moving from one financial institution to another, the IRS has saved the paperwork. Most requests by taxpayers to move from one financial institution, to move their IRA from one financial institution, is really what we call a transfer. Another type of movement is what we call a rollover, right? The only time a rollover occurs is if a distribution takes place. It's really two transactions. In a rollover, in order for a person to put money back, they must have taken it out initially. In other words, the first part of a rollover is a distribution. A distribution from an IRA is reportable. In other words, a 1099-R must be issued to the individual at the end of the year. However, the rollover will then in turn offset the amount that is has been distributed and put back in. However, if the amount that was distributed is more than the amount that was put back in, well, any amounts that never was rolled back in will in turn be taxable and in some cases be subject to a penalty if the individual is under the age of 59 and a half. IRA to IRA rollover rules. When must a rollover be completed? It must be completed 60 days after the day of constructive receipts. In other words, if a person receives a distribution today, well, day one starts tomorrow. In other words, how to count that will be day one be tomorrow, and then after 60 days from that, that amount can no longer be rolled back in. If the 60th day falls on a weekend, well, guess what? Have them make it to the financial institution in the prior business day, because the 60-day rollover is not a tax act. So therefore, they don't get the following business day under Section 7503 of the Internal Revenue Code. I just went nerdy on you. 7503 of the Internal Revenue Code says that only a tax act, if a tax act falls on a weekend or a holiday, then they get the following business day. IRA rollovers is not a tax act. The same property must be rolled back as well. If it's an IRA to IRA rollover, in other words, if we distribute a property again, the taxpayer who has the property now cannot sell the property and roll back in cash. It must be the same property. Required minimum distributions are not eligible for rollover. If a person is over the age of 72 and they're taking what we call required minimum distributions, those are not eligible for rollover. Inherited IRAs of non-spouse beneficiaries. In other words, if a person in an IRA died and they've left it to an inheritor, in other words, a beneficiary cannot take a distribution and roll that back. That is a little bit different than a 401k inheritor. If a 401k plan participant passed away and somebody inherited those dollars, they can roll that into an inherited IRA. However, an inheritor in an IRA cannot take a distribution and roll it over. Any portion of the distribution not rolled back again, as mentioned earlier, will be subject to a tax and penalty. So it's essential that if a person really wants to nullify the taxation, that they roll over the full amount. In other words, make that up out of their pocket. The IRA holder must also make an irrevocable election when they're putting it back in. Where does that come from? The Unemployment Compensation Amendment of 1992, according to law, requires that they must make an irrevocable election. Some financial institution uses what we call a rollover certification form. If you don't have one of those, you may want to talk to your forms provider and acquire one or come up with one yourself as a financial institution as a means of making the irrevocable election that they're putting that money back in. And last but not least, IRA to IRA rollovers are limited to one in a 12-month period. In other words, if somebody makes a distribution today and rolls it back in within 60 days, they cannot take another distribution and roll it back in until the same date in which they took that initial distribution. So in other words, if a person took a distribution on February 1st of 2021 and they rolled it back in within 60 days, the next time they can take another distribution is February 1st of 2022. This one rollover per 12-month rule applies to traditional, Roth, SEP IRAs, and simple IRAs combined. So in other words, if a person took a distribution and rolled it back in, that nullifies their eligibility for a distribution and roll over within the same 12-month period from all of those IRAs. What if a person wasn't eligible to roll it back in and there was a reasonable reason? The IRS came up with what we call Revenue Procedure 2016-47 and 2020-46, which expanded the reasons to allow for an individual to self-certify. So in other words, if a financial institution, of course, has a rollover certification form, the client says that I'm rolling over this amount past the 60-day period, you might tell the client, well, you're not eligible to roll it over. However, if the client goes, well, I have a self-certification letter that I do qualify for one of the exemptions, well, a financial institution can take that self-certification letter and basically accept that rollover. Now, if the individual gets into an audit and the individual is questioned by the Internal Revenue Service, well, then the financial institution is off the hook, and that's between the IRA holder, and the IRS. All right. A self-certification, a sample, is a part of that revenue procedure that was issued by the Internal Revenue Service. Right? Reasons allowed for self-certification, of course, the financial institution error. As you can see, you know, I'm not going to go through all the different reasons, but it is stated on that on the self-certification letter. All right. Another example in this slide: taxpayer was incarcerated. You're probably wondering, where in the world did they get these reasons? Because where they got these reasons, because it used to be so inexpensive to apply for a private letter ruling. It was only $95. And the IRS has basically awarded favorable ruling for certain situations, and they basically listed those particular situations on a self-certification form. Now, if they want to apply for a private letter ruling to date, it'll cost them $10,000. But thank God we actually have some old private letter rulings that the IRS actually put on a sample letter as a means of self-certifying that an individual is eligible to roll over dollars past a 60-day period. If an individual does have questions on whether or not certain assets can be rolled to and from any retirement plan, the IRS has a wonderful rollover chart. In other words, if a person is questioning you, the financial institution, on whether or not, you know, what you're telling them is true, well, refer them to the IRS rollover chart. And of course, how do you contest the IRS when the IRS actually has it published to the public on their IRS website? All right. The last thing we're going to talk about are RMDs. Now, keep in mind, RMDs are for individuals that have attained age 72 or older. They have to take out a minimum amount. It used to be age 70 and a half. So for individuals that turned age 70 and a half prior to 2020, they need to continue taking required minimum distributions. But moving forward, that age to start taking required minimum distribution, required minimum distributions has been increased to age 72. Once a person reaches age 72, they're typically required to take out a required minimum distribution by December 31st of every year. Again, the typical deadline to distribute an RMD is December 31st of every year. However, for the first year alone, they can postpone that first year's required minimum distribution up until April Fool's Day of the year following. So in other words, April 1st of the year following the age 72 year. What they don't tell you, however, is that if a person postpones it, well, they have two that subsequent year. So you either get ding for every year, or you get ding, or in other words, ding dong, you got two for that following year if they postpone their first year's RMD. Failure to take out an RMD has a penalty, and that penalty is 50%. That is what we call the excess accumulation penalty. That's the fancy-smancy term for the 50% penalty. And if you really want to go take it a step further, being nerdy about it, it's Section 4974 of the Internal Revenue Code. If an RMD is not distributed, the taxpayer may be subject to what we call a 50% penalty on the amount failed to be distributed. Now, keep in mind, that's only on the minimum amount, all right? Any amounts that have been distributed is not subject to that 50% penalty, but if an amount is failed to be distributed, 50% of that amount will be subject to the penalty. And the penalty is paid using the IRS Form 5329. Filed with their tax return. And the reason why I say the term maybe is because what if an individual has a reasonable cause or a reasonable reason why they fail to take out a distribution called an RMD? Well, the IRS says, well, put forth a good faith effort to correct the issue. What's the most prudent way to correct the issue? Distribute the RMD even if it's after the due date. And then from there, using the IRS Form 5329, and it's on Part 9, I believe, also of this form, is where they will tell the IRS the amount that would have been subject to the 50% penalty and put RC on the particular line. I believe it's line 53 of that form, and attach a letter on the back of that form stating that, you know, stating what their reason is, whether it be they got stuck outside of the country because of a terrorist attack and they can't get back to the United States and request their distribution, whatever it may be. And some of those may be a part of the list of the rollover certification form, right? If there's a reasonable cause on why they were not able to take out the required minimum distribution, well, the IRS would reserve the right to waive that 50% penalty for that individual required to take a distribution. Now, how do we calculate an RMD? Now, some of you folks have your systems that calculate RMDs, but if you're going to calculate it manually, this is how it works. Take the prior year end's balance. In other words, if you're calculating an RMD for 2021, you use tax year 2020's year-end balance. In other words, the fair market value for tax year 2020. From there, it has to be adjusted. I will talk about the adjustments in a second. Once you get the prior year-end balance, you divide it by a life expectancy. Now, let's take a look in greater detail what that means to have the prior year-end balance as a part of that calculation. Right? The prior year-end balance must be adjusted by outstanding rollovers and transfers. In other words, if a person took a distribution by the end of tax year 2020, if he took everything out of the IRA, what's the balance in that person's IRA? Zero. Does that mean they don't have an RMD? The answer is, it depends. It depends on whether or not that individual who took a distribution rolled it back in. Let's say they rolled it back in January 10th of 2021. That amount needs to be added back to the prior year-end balance to calculate the RMD. Same goes for a transfer. If a person was transferring from one institution to another and the amount was in transit, of course, it's not going to be in the fair market value of that person's IRA at the end of the year. That amount also needs to be added back in. Now, how is a financial institution going to know that? You won't, unless, of course, you ask, right? You know, during the 60-day period at the beginning of the year, and you see somebody over 70 and a half, rolling over assets, that's why you have that rollover certification form. It asks things like, is there any portion of this amount that you're rolling over, a part of your R&D? Then if they have any questions on that, that's the time to be able to educate, and hopefully the IRA holder would be able to identify whether or not, you know, they did certain things such as take a distribution in the prior year that they're rolling over, or they process a transfer that did not hit the receiving IRA until the subsequent year. The next thing in the formula is what we call a life expectancy divisor. The typical life expectancy we use is what we call the uniform lifetime table. The uniform lifetime table is a life expectancy of two people, the age of the IRA holder as of their birthday for the year and an assumed beneficiary automatically 10 years younger. So if a person is 71, then the beneficiary is 61, 72, 62. 73, you get the point, right? However, if an individual is married to someone a lot younger than 10 years and the spouse is a sole beneficiary, as a matter of fact, a good example is that I was doing a compliance audit in San Francisco. An 80-year-old married a 21-year-old. The 21-year-old has a huge life expectancy. So therefore, why would they penalize that couple for falling in love? So in other words, instead of assuming that age 21 spouse to be age 70, the IRS says if it's the spouse and the spouse is the sole beneficiary and they're greater than 10 years younger, then they can use the true age of that spouse to determine the life expectancy. Of course, will be a lot larger. That will make the required minimum distribution a lot smaller. So again, generally, the table that is used is the uniform lifetime table, unless, of course, the beneficiary is a spouse and the spouse is the sole beneficiary and the spouse is greater than 10 years younger. Then the joint life expectancy table can be used. Here is a snapshot of the uniform life expectancy table, which is subject to change in 2022 because new tax tables have been provided by the IRS, and life expectancies have been increased. Here's a sample of the joint life expectancy table. Now, keep in mind, this is a longer table. This is just a part of it, all right? And here's a snapshot of the current versus proposed. What you will find is that the life expectancy factor for under the new table will give the another year or two added on to the current life expectancy factor to calculate RMDs moving forward. In other words, it's going to further reduce the required minimum distribution because, you know, of course, people are living longer. So therefore, the minimum amount can be reduced by additional life expectancy increase in the life expectancy factor. RMD notice, one of the last things we're going to take a look at, the RMD notice states that a financial institution must provide a taxpayer a reminder that they have to take out an RMD in the year that the fair market value is created. So in other words, January 31st of every calendar year, if an individual has a fair market value, of course, at your financial institution, and they're required to take a required minimum distribution, the organization must either provide the individual an amount of their RMD or offer to calculate the RMD for that taxpayer. They must also tell the taxpayer the deadline on when that RMD must be distributed, and that the financial institution is actually telling the IRS that they have a required minimum distribution due for the year. Now, for Roth IRAs, if this was a Roth IRA class, we would have been done in 30 seconds because there are no required minimum distributions to Roth IRA holders while they're alive. What do I mean by that? Once a person passes away, the beneficiary options typically are found in the required minimum distribution rules now apply to beneficiaries. The beneficiary options are what we call required minimum distributions for beneficiaries. All right. Now let's open up the phones for any questions you may have in regards to the materials presented. I've been talking for quite a while. Let's open up the phone lines, or let's open up any questions that people may have in regards to the materials presented.
Hey, JP. So nothing entered yet. So anybody on the line, if you would like to ask JP a question, feel free to enter that in the questions box. I'm also more than happy to unmute you if you'd like to raise your hand and speak with JP. Just raise your hand and I can also do that as well. In the meantime, JP, is there any common questions, any FAQs, pardon me, that you get about RMD or transfers versus rollovers, anything you've covered thus far, anything kind of top of mind that you think might be worth explaining as anyone thinks of questions they may have?
Sure. A common question people have is if a person has an RMD for the year, and of course the deadline is December 31st, can an individual transfer the whole IRA and distribute the RMD at the end of the year? And the answer is yes, because a transfer is not a distribution. So therefore, if an individual wants to move their whole IRA from one institution to the other without having to satisfy the RMD first, they can do so as long as the IRA holder remembers that they have a distribution that they need to take at the end of the year. To avoid that 50% penalty, of course, obviously the 50% penalty. Another question that a lot of individuals may have, especially in the self-directed IRA world, in other words, they may have assets in their IRA that is not liquid. In other words, it's in the form of property. How do they take a distribution? For example, let's say a piece of real estate, right? There's no cash. How do they distribute from that? Well, some people may say, well, can we just register a portion of the piece of real estate out, from the IRA name to themselves? They can absolutely do that. It becomes very expensive. Another option, another question, what they say is, if I don't have anything to distribute, well, I'll be subject to a 50% penalty. That's an option that they could actually avail of. Now, Some IRA holders have worked with their taxpayer that by the time they pay the federal tax, in some cases the state tax, they may not be up to 50%, but darn well close to the 50% amount of the penalty. So in other words, they're thinking to themselves, if I have nothing to distribute, but I do like this investment because I know it's going to give me a great return, let's say 3 or 5 years from now, would it be worth it for me to pay the 50% penalty? And some have decided they'll just go ahead and pay the 50% penalty. In other words, the RMD rules state that it's either you take out the required minimum amount, and of course you're going to be subject to tax and penalty on that amount distributed, or just pay the 50% penalty. So in other words, if that's the choices that an IRA holder has, well, an IRA holder sometimes may choose to pay the 50% penalty in lieu of having to distribute their required minimum distribution. All right. Do we have any other questions? Or did I do such a good... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, you did an amazing job, but we do have a question from AJ. Thank you, AJ. Question regarding converting a non-deductible IRA to a Roth. Mm-hmm. So question is, okay. If no other pre-tax IRAs in 2020 and a non-deductible IRA contribution is made and then converted mm-hmm. to a Roth, I understand mm-hmm. no tax will be due. However, what happens if there is a pre-tax IRA inherited in the same year after the conversion was done? Is the conversion subject to pro rata tax based on the sequence? Thank you, AJ.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. If an individual made a contribution called a non-deductible contribution and there are no other IRA assets, let's do two scenarios, right? And let's say there's no other IRA assets that are being distributed by this particular taxpayer. Well, the non-deductible contribution, if they decide to convert it, will not be taxable at all because there shouldn't be any earnings on that amount, right? Because they're including it as taxable income for the year. So therefore, they are actually essentially paying tax on it. However, if there are other assets, including inherited accounts, that are going to be distributable under this particular taxpayer, that amount needs to be added to the total balance of an individual's accounts that are going to be subject to taxation. And unfortunately, you can't just say, I want to convert my non-deductible contributions from a traditional IRA to a Roth. Under a notice in 1987 because of the Taxpayer Relief Act of Tax Reform Act of 86, it says that if you're taking the distribution from an IRA or IRAs that contain both non-deductible and pre-tax assets, you can't just say, I want to take the distribution out of my non-deductible. You have to prorate it. In other words, it has to come out of each bucket. So in other words, if let's say the balance in the IRAs are $10,000 at the end of the year and $1,000 is the non-deductible contribution, that tells the individual that only one-tenth of the IRA distribution will be non-taxable. So to answer your question, AJ, if there are other taxable amounts, well, that's going to spoil the conversion for that individual because they're probably assuming that it's not going to be taxable. Now it's going to be taxable because there are assets that have never been taxed before that it's being distributed from other IRAs that the individual is now taking distributions from to determine taxation of the distribution. I hope that answers your question.
As an update there said, so they understand the pro rata rule, but does sequence in the year matter? So they were trying to lay out the order in which these events happened and asked if that affects the end result or affects that rule.
If the sequence, to address that question, if the sequence happens within a tax year, it doesn't matter. It's not going to make a difference. And the reasoning behind that is because every transaction that happens during the year is basically accumulated for all all distributions made within a calendar year. So in other words, they're not going to be treated differently within the calendar year if sequentially they happen within the calendar year, right? If it did not happen within the calendar year, so in other words, in this particular year, somebody made a non-deductible contribution, they don't have any other IRAs, and they wanted to do a conversion, hey, knock yourself out. There's no taxation in that conversion. However, of course, that amount is includable as taxable income because they weren't able to use it as a tax deduction, right? So that's 1 year. And let's say they inherit the subsequent year, well, then that's a completely different story. But the sequential order that happens within the calendar year, it'll be subject to the proration rules. I hope that answers your question, AJ.
Great, thank you, JP. There are no other questions that I'm getting now. So unless anybody has a last minute question you would like to punch in, or if you want to raise your hand, I can unmute you. Otherwise, JP, are there any top of mind FAQs, or if you want to, you can round us out?
Well, I pondered a lot of information within the hour. If you want to learn more about the IRA Academy and please don't hesitate to give us a call. A lot of individuals that have taken the IRA Academy for over 15 years or so since its inception, has found the information that they learn from that class very valuable. We do cover more than what we have in the material. And it's one thing to pass the exam, but it's also one thing to be able to take back information that will be helpful to run your IRA programs at your financial institutions. So I highly encourage you folks to, if you're interested, please let us know. And in the future, we are going to be coming out with an IRA Academy on demand. The IRA Academy on demand is a self-paced study portal that contains videos, pronouncements, all these different things that you need to put in your knowledge bucket to be an IRA professional. And it will also prepare you for the CISP exam. I also conduct on-site trainings for financial institutions, as well as webinars if that's what they wanted. And we can customize trainings for your financial institution from the most basic to the more advanced individuals. So if you folks are ever interested in that, let us know. We do love to educate and assist people in their careers as a retirement professional. Right. I don't believe there are any other questions, right, Andrew? Or
correct. Yeah, JP, you can send us home. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for attending today's seminar. And we'd love to have you in our IRA Academy in May, as well as IRA Academy in September. Or if you wanted us to go on site, not us, but myself, go on site and train for your financial institution. Again, it doesn't have to be the full 4 days. It could be broken out into a basic class or an intermediate or advanced class, depending upon what your financial institution needs, as well as if you wanted to branch out into individual 401k training for your financial institution, we can do that as well. Again, my name is John Paul Ruiz, Director of Professional Development here at the Entrust Group, and thank you for attending today's webinar, and looking forward to meeting you in person.